again, and welcome to episode 19 of Be Boomer Unleashed, as we discuss the evolution of the church and Christian values enter the megachurch part 2. I'm Jerry Lake, and I'm your host for this and all episodes of Be Boomer Unleashed, and we're so glad you saw fit to come back and spend the next 25 minutes or so with us today as we discuss the church through the ages from the 1950s on up to present time. Last week, we talked about the megachurch part 1. We're going to continue that discussion this week, and we may finish that discussion today or we may not, but we have other episodes planned along this same line as we follow the local church from the 1950s through the current day and how it's changed, not only in the organization, but in the doctrine and some of the teachings of that church. Before we get into today's discussion, let me remind you, you can always find us at beboomerunleashed.podbean.com. You can find our link on Facebook, iTunes, Spotify, Tumblr, Instagram, or Google Play at Be Boomer Unleashed. You can find us on Twitter at Be Boomer Unleashed 1. And as always, we encourage you to send us emails at beboomerunleashed@gmail.com. That's beboomerunleashed@gmail.com. We're glad to hear from you. We're also appreciative of the comments that you leave on the podcast website, and we have taken a lot of those ideas that you've given them and tried to weave them in to the podcast, past podcasts, and we'll be weaving some more of those into our podcasts in the future. I was talking to a good friend of mine the other day. Matter of fact, I had breakfast with him. That's Bill Smith. He's our former superintendent of schools here in Cabell County, and Bill is a tremendous friend of mine. We've been friends for years, and I asked him if he'd come on the show as a guest here sometime in the next few weeks when we finish up this discussion on the church, and I would like to talk to Bill, have him talk to us about growing up black in the 50s and 60s, and about the civil rights movement, and where it's been, and where it's gone to, and where it's going, and he said he would be happy to do that, and so we'll be bringing Bill Smith on as a guest here in the not-too-distant future. Well, if you'll remember, last week we talked about breaking up our conversation about the church into two distinct paths. One is church organization, and when we talk about church organization, we're talking about buildings, methods of ministry, that kind of thing. And then we're talking about the next path that we'll talk about, our church teachings. Have the core values of the local church changed since the 50s? And we'll also take a look at what Christianity in practice looks like today and what it looked like back in the 1950s. So that's where this discussion is going, and we hope that you'll tune into every episode. And if you have comments or questions, once again, please email us at beboomerunleashed@gmail.com. Love to hear from you and love to hear those comments. If you would like us to go down another path or mention something else that we haven't mentioned on the show, we would certainly appreciate your input. Now, we've already talked about going to church in the 50s, and we talked about that church being led by the greatest generation and how they were community-oriented, and then we talked about the sexual revolution of the 1960s and how it infiltrated the local church, and although the leadership was still primarily of that greatest generation, the baby boomers, most of us were coming of age during the 60s, and we had more influence and more things to say about the local church. And then in the 70s, our boomers are primarily in leadership position. Now, we still have some of the greatest generation in that in those leadership roles of the local church, but the boomers were taking a much more active part in the administration, in the ministry of the local church. You remember we talked about the baby boomers. We always thought we had a better idea, and we were rebellious. We didn't like the status quo, and we wanted to change things lots of times just for the sake of changing them. And that's kind of what happened in the mega church movement that began, I think, in the 1970s. And for the purpose of this discussion, as I said, we're talking about Protestant churches with a membership of at least 2,000. Speaking of Protestant churches, I also want to have one of my buddies, a real good Catholic friend of mine, join me on the show one day and see if there have been changes that he's noticed in the Catholic Church since the 1950s up till today. And that'll be an interesting discussion too. But for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to talk about Protestant churches with a membership of at least 2,000 to be identified as a mega church. Now, remember, November 1970, there were only 10 churches in the United States identified by those standards as a mega church. By 1990, there were 250, and today there are over 750 of those churches in the United States identified as mega churches, and their average attendance, although we're using as our litmus test 2,000, membership of 2,000, the average attendance of these mega churches today is over 3,500. The average net income, remember that's income after all your expenses have been paid, of these churches is nearly $5 million a year. And the largest mega church identified in the U.S. today is Joel Osteen's Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas. They have an average attendance of about 25,000, and Osteen's personal net worth, we're not talking about the church, but his personal net worth is reported to be around or over $40 million. So, as we said, there was obviously too much to cover in one episode, so we'll be parking here for just a little while talking about this mega church through the decades, and part of that mega church, we'll get into that discussion a little bit later too, has to do with the electronic church or the TV church and what that's done to ministry in local churches today. Well, the mega church, as we said, has changed the way we reach people. And in many cases, they've changed biblical doctrines to conform to man's image instead of God's. And we're going to take our time as we attempt to discuss these important issues. Now, remember we got into the discussion of the formula for success of these mega churches. And although that formula was not ill-intentioned, I don't believe in any way that somebody was ill-intentioned the way they started, but that formula for success, we started last week with a discussion on buses and bus ministry and how every church had to have a large fleet of buses and they were in competition with other churches. If you missed that discussion, I encourage you to tune in to episode 18 and listen to that discussion. But in the 70s, buses were probably numero uno, the number one ingredient for a successful megachurch or mini megachurch or megachurch wannabe. Now, the remaining ingredients that we're going to share with you or begin sharing with you today may not necessarily be in any particular order, but they were also ingredients of that megachurch and what made them grow and how they got to that status of megachurch. Now, buses, as we said, was a number one ingredient. Then we come to something like Christian schools and or Christian colleges. So every church that wanted to be a mega church, it seemed like they had to have a Christian school, a K-12 Christian school. And some of them went on beyond that and opened their own Christian colleges. Now, there were several colleges back in the day that a lot of folks from these independent fundamental Baptist churches went off to. They had Liberty Bible College down in Lynchburg, Virginia. They had Hiles Anderson College up in Indiana. They had Tennessee Temple down in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They had Moody Bible Institute up in Chicago. There were all these institutions, these colleges, these Christian colleges, that most of them were part of a local church, but these Christian colleges trained people to come back and build mega churches, basically, is what they did. And not to say Christian education is bad, you know, I think we ought to, if somebody's going to be in the ministry, they ought to have some sort of Christian education. That doesn't mean every pastor has to have a seminary degree or even a college degree, but they should seek after some sort of training to help them in the pastor. But these Christian schools, many of them were real similar in nature, and they taught you to go out and go back and grow these churches, because their example church or their laboratory church, if you will, was a mega church in their own right. So that's what the goal of most of these graduates of these colleges was, is to come out and go and plant and build mega churches. So the Christian school and or Christian college was definitely one of the ingredients of building a local mega church or a mega mini church or a mega church wannabe, if you will. And a lot of that was going on in the 70s. Now, in the 1970s, in my hometown, or the hometown surrounding area of Huntington, West Virginia, and we have what we call the tri-state area, which includes Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia, and there's Huntington proper, and then there's Metro Huntington, which is outlying Huntington, if you will. And in the 70s, there were 9 Christian schools within 10 miles of each other in our area. 9 Christian schools, kindergarten through the 12th grade. Now, when you're talking about a total population in the area at that time, in the metro area of probably less than 100,000 people, and you had 9 K through 12 Christian schools within 10 miles of each other, that's quite a bit of competition for those dollars for the students. And not only were there 9 Christian schools, Protestant Christian schools, but there was also a Catholic school in the area too, and a couple of Catholic junior high schools. So there was a lot of competition for those private school dollars. Every church that was going to be what they thought they were going to turn into some megachurch felt they had to have a Christian school, grades K through 12. And a lot of those schools revolved around sports. You know, they would have big basketball teams, and they didn't play too much football because, you know, it cost a lot to outfit a football team. A basketball team didn't cost quite as much, a few uniforms and tennis shoes, and they usually had tennis and golf and those sports that didn't cost a whole lot of money. But primarily, they weren't very much into producing revenue on those sports either. So the basketball program, if you will, had to carry the athletic budget. Churches who had these Christian schools, some of them bought big Greyhound-type buses to haul their basketball teams around in, and everybody felt they had to have a big bus or something, not only just the bus like they pick kids up with in the on Sunday, but a bus to go on their sporting outings. And so, you know, we wanted our boys to arrive first class, and, you know, they had their shirts and ties and all that stuff on, and they were a good-looking lot when they got off the bus, and that was a big deal back in those days for the Christian schools. But how does an area with less than 100,000 population support 9 Christian schools and a Catholic school? And you've got all these other public schools around and about. Well, they don't survive. That's why there were 9 of those Christian schools and a Catholic school in the tri-state area back in 1970. Today, there are 2 Christian schools and 1 Catholic school. The same Catholic school is still there. They provide a great education for the students, but those 9 Christian schools have now turned into 2. They never paid their own way, ever. Just like a public school, they don't pay their way. You know, we pay a lot of taxes to support public schools, but then we've got to get federal grant money, and schools do fundraisers and all kinds of things to try to make money to pay the bills at the school. But in the private school in particular, you had the tuition money. Then you had to rely on fundraisers, and many times the local church where that school was attached footed the bill for the school. And a lot of times people kind of got tired of doing that. They didn't have a kid or a grandkid in the Christian school, and all their tithe money was going in and paying for activities for the Christian school or curriculum for the Christian school. So the churches had to kind of look at the Christian school as an outreach ministry. Now, most of those churches probably could have maintained a K through 5 or a K through 6 Christian school, and could have left the high school up to maybe 1 church, and all of those schools fed into that 1 high school. But no, everybody had to have their own. And Christian schools were started for a variety of reasons. I know one school in our area, for example, I was personally involved in that school, started over a pair of culottes. And the pastor's daughters were going to another Christian school in the area, and the gym uniform was sweatpants. And his girls didn't wear pants. They weren't allowed to wear pants. That was ungodly to wear those pants, you know. So he wanted them to wear culottes, and he went and met with the pastor there, who was also the president of the school, and said, you know, can't we come to some kind of an agreement here where my daughters can wear culottes? And the answer was no. The uniform for gym class is sweatpants. So following that meeting, I happened to be doing something there at the church, and the pastor came in, and he was just like a mad as an old wet hen. And he said, you know, I didn't want to do it, didn't really want to do it, but I guess I'm going to have to start our own school. So one school, at least, was started over a pair of culottes or sweatpants. Other schools were started because, hey, you know, if they start a school, we've got to start a school because they're going to have more kids in their church than we do, and yada, blah, yada. And the next thing you know, you've got too many Christian schools. Nobody is able to succeed. And pretty soon they fold up and they close up, and the churches really were hurt financially over that. As a matter of fact, I was in a meeting before our church started a Christian school back in the day with the pastor and some other men, and Curtis Hudson from down in Georgia. And we were talking about starting a Christian school. And he said, you know, you can start a Christian school, but I can promise you this, it'll hurt your church. If you want to do that for ministry, that's all well and good, but your church will be hurt as a result of that Christian school because it's going to be a drain financially on your church. And he was right, but not many people listened. They all wanted to do their own thing. They all wanted to have their own school and their own sports teams. And so there you go. There you have it. So the Christian school movement, by and large, I think was partly due to churches not wanting other churches to get ahead of them. And, you know, you can say what you want. You can say, well, it's a ministry. They didn't want the kids in the public schools, yada, blah. And I'm sure that was part of it. But having been on the inside of those discussions, I found that often that Christian school was there because other churches were having those Christian schools, and we didn't want that church, you know, to get ahead of us, so we got to have a Christian school too. And not always the case. And I'm all in favor of Christian education. Don't get me wrong. I'm in favor of Christian education. Hey, we homeschooled our kid. And my daughter went to public school through the fourth grade, and my son went to public school through the second grade. And we elected to homeschool our children primarily because my son was kind of had ants in his pants, call it ADD or ADHD or whatever you want. And we had the choice of either medicating him and sending him to school like a zombie or trying to school him at home. And we opted for the homeschool route. And it worked out really good for us. Now, that's not to say that the homeschooling is right for everybody. And that's not to say public school is not right for some people. You are the parent. You are the one who has to decide what is in the best interest of your son or your daughter. You can't let somebody else make that decision for you. There was a lot of pressure in churches with Christian schools for the parishioners to put their children in that school. And if you didn't put your children into that school, you were kind of ostracized. And then what happened to these churches that had Christian schools, many times those school activities became the youth activities for the church. So if you had a child that was in church and not in that Christian school, there really wasn't anything for them. There really wasn't any youth activity for them. It became the youth activity of the school, became the youth activity of the church. And if you weren't going to that school, then you didn't have an opportunity to participate in those youth activities. So, yeah, in many respects, it hurt the church. Most churches will tell you that a Christian school kind of hurts the church. Now, some churches have risen above that. We have a great Christian school in Huntington, and they seem to have risen above that, and they've learned how to balance the activities of the school with the activities of the church, and they've done very well with it. And we think it's a quality school where the kids are getting a quality education. The Catholic school seems to be flourishing there in Huntington, and they do a good job and give the kids a quality education in small classes. Unlike the public schools that have 28 to 30 or more sometimes in classes, and you know, the class loads in many of these Christian schools is down around a 15 or so. So, you know, obviously you're going to have a better opportunity at a good education if you're in a class size of 15 than you are in a class size of 28 or 30. I know when I taught in public school, you know, there were a lot of times I had 34, 35 kids in a classroom. But, you know, that was back then. I wouldn't want to really be doing that now. Times, they certainly have changed. You know, used to, you had some disciplinary action. You could hold over a child's head to make them behave. But today, not so much. You know, you get in trouble at school, then mommy and daddy are going to be in tomorrow taking up for you and trying to tell the teacher or the principal that their child can do no wrong. So Christian schools and or Christian colleges, and like I say, some of them even had Christian colleges. We had a couple or three churches in our area that gave it a stab at a Christian college, and most of them were short-lived, didn't last long there. But that was another ingredient that the baby boomers felt churches needed if they were going to be successful in becoming a mega church or driving force in the community. So buses, and the buses that were originally meant for church bus ministry now became buses that were hauling kids in for the Christian school. So the bus ministry at church, the buses had double usage in that they were able to be utilized in transporting children to and from school. Pay was historically low for teachers in Christian schools, and to some degree today, that's still true. But I know, you know, I taught at a Christian school for a year or two back in the 70s. You know, public school teachers at that time were making about $1,200 a month, and at that Christian school, we were making $600 a month. Quite a bit of difference, about half price that you got for working in a Christian school, so it was a definite sacrifice. But hey, I got an extra $50 a month. Now think of this. I got an extra $50 a month to drive the bus and pick kids up on the way to school. So it was kind of like having a company car because I got to drive the bus home with me at night. And, you know, so I got an extra $50 a month. Imagine that, driving a school bus. How many of you school bus drivers out there would like to haul kids to school for $50 a month? So buses, Christian schools, they kind of went hand in hand, and that was one of the other ingredients for a successful church or for a church to have any chance of becoming a mega church in the 1970s. Wow. We certainly spent a lot of time there talking about that and didn't quite get to where we wanted to get today. But you know what? I'm in no hurry, unless you're in a big hurry. We'll have another episode ready for you next week. But we're going to talk about, I've got about four more ingredients of the successful church of the 70s and their attempt to become mega church. So about four more ingredients to go through. And then when we get through those, then we'll move on to the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s and the growth of the TV church and televangelism and the electronic church and all of those implications. And then as soon as we finish that up, then we're going to talk about, probably spend two or three weeks on talking about how the core values of the church have changed over the years. And then when we finish that up, maybe we can get our friend Bill Smith on. We'll talk about some civil rights of the 50s and 60s, what it was like to grow up black in the 50s and 60s. I think that's going to be a very interesting discussion. Bill is a delightful friend and quite a man of character. I appreciate him, appreciated working for him for all those years, appreciated our work relationship, but I appreciate our friendship even more. Well, listen, just hang in there till next week. We'll talk more about this formula for the successful church. Got a lot more to discuss, but we've got all the time in the world. Hopefully you've enjoyed today's broadcast. If you did, share it on Facebook or other places that you share things like this. If you don't like it, like I say, don't tell anybody how lousy we are, okay? Hey, it's been great being with you. We look forward to being with you again next week. Have a great, great week, and may God bless each and every one of you. Goodbye.